Now, government is finalising new guidelines for the pub, live events and nightclub sectors, which are due to be published this afternoon ahead of their reopening tomorrow. And one element of the reopening will be the return of smoking areas. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line now by Professor Luke Clancy, Director General of the Tobacco Free Research Institute of Ireland. Luke, you're very welcome to the programme.
Good afternoon.
Suppose smoking areas have been a bone of contention for many people well in advance of the beginning of the pandemic, but it's taken on a new tone given that we're living with a virus transmitted through the air.
Well, that's correct. And a virus that has brought big mortality in this country. But as we're talking about smoking has killed nearly 12,000 people since the epidemic began, the virus epidemic began, and less than 5,000 from actual COVID. So as a killer of people, smoking has done much more, even now in this time of the pandemic. And yet we seem to be not paying much attention to it just now. Now, Ireland has a good reputation, as you know, for tobacco control, has done a lot. And one of the most important things it did was to ban smoking in the workplace and in pubs and clubs. And this had a really big effect on tobacco control. And we saw a decline in smoking, which has continued, and a particular decline in young people, even though they weren't, you might think, directly affected by it. So when we think about reopening pubs, we say, well, how could anybody countenance reopening the outside smoking areas, which are not really outside as a misnomer. They're very often integrated or nearly integrated, and certainly they're small areas where people crowd and they pass secondhand smoke, but also any virus that might be around. So it's unthinkable to me. And also where it was noticeable was when people started eating outside, and they were also smoking outside, which was never intended. There was never supposed to be any smoking where there was food. And instead of things improving, they seem to have deteriorated or been ignored during the pandemic. So it's a chance for them not to make this mistake again. As it happens, we were involved in an 8-country examination of outside areas, and we found that the level of secondhand smoke, far from being negligible, was as high in some areas as it had been in pubs before the bans were introduced.
You've touched on this just a moment ago. A lot of the smoking areas in Ireland are really akin to indoor rooms. And is that transmission or concentration of secondhand smoke across those smoking areas in 8 countries examined, did that take into account the manner and tone of the smoking area?
Absolutely. Now, there are rules more than rules, there's laws describing what should constitute an outdoor area. But it's often breached and they often close it off. You know, they erect it in compliance and then fill it in. But also, if you remember, there was to be no service in any outdoor area. There was to be no ashtrays. And now you can go in and often you see television and ashtrays, etc. This was never intended. And that's contravention of the actual law. But we, as I was saying, we measured secondhand smoke in these pubs. And most of them, some of them, about a third of them were not compliant. But even the compliant ones had very high levels of secondhand smoke, which was never expected or intended. And what's worse is not only do people who smoke go there, which defeats the purpose of it, but also they go with their friends who are often non-smokers. And you get this exposure to secondhand smoke just as if they were in the pub of old. So this is a chance to clean that up.
So should smoking areas be done away with in public life entirely, in your view?
They should, I believe. And also this consortium that I was part of made that recommendation to the EU, whom we hope when they do revise, but often these things take years, that they will be proposing this. I think they have no place. They don't work. They were a compromise that we agreed to at the time because people said, oh, this is unfair. The poor old man with his pint have to have somewhere to go. Now, we found that it wasn't the polar mammoth point, and we've been surveying young people, teenagers, who say with nightclubs and so on, they actually quite like these outside areas because the music isn't as loud and they can talk to their friends and they can be rolling cigarettes or using e-cigarettes, whatever they like. So it is defeating the purpose. And the big point is there are two problems with that. One is that it's bad for the people and it will cause disease. But the second is that the culture against tobacco now was so strong, and this weakens it, and we're in danger. And we see this with the prevalence of smoking in boys rising again. For 20 years, every survey showed a decline until the last one in 2019, when it actually increased. So it's not working. We have to get rid of these outdoor areas.
I would imagine that there would be a certain amount of angst at a proposal to completely abolish the concept of the smoking area, because I would imagine in many establishments sort of what it will do is push people who elect to smoke or vape of an evening out onto the street, whereas historically they were on the premises that they were attending.
Well, they may, but it's a bit safer. But there is also the alternative, and what did happen to a lot of people is they've stopped smoking. And this, of course, is the incentive. You know, if people find that they don't have to, it helps them to consider to stop smoking. And they will and do. So, you know, it's funny that people are accepting such restrictions on their lifestyles at present, you know, with the lockdowns, etc., from a disease that is terrible, but hasn't killed anything like the number of people that smoking continues to kill now. So this is so important. And I don't think the politicians can use the excuse that the people won't put up with it. The people do care. Mm. And they did obey the smoke-free laws when they were instituted and still do. But this is an anomaly that we must get rid of. And it's not good enough to say the people won't tolerate it. The people will. And it is popular, and most people don't smoke.
Mm. Professor Luke Clancy, Director General of the Tobacco Free Research Institute of Ireland, thank you indeed for joining us. You can get in touch with your comments on that. I know that Professor Clancy's statement that all smoking areas should be completely done away with in public life might be a little controversial. 0833 97 97 97. Joe has gotten in touch on this matter. Joe, I'm not quite sure I understand your text. So you say, so it was people outside smoking, eating, drinking, talking, children in schools, old people in homes. What next, aliens? If you want to resend that, I'd be delighted to read it, but we're not quite sure what you're referring to there. In Armagh, where a controversial service took place earlier today, I'm joined on the line to discuss this by political correspondent Sean Defoe. Sean, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks for having me.
Delighted to do so. Much debate, some of it acrimonious, in the run-up to this event following President Higgins' declining of an invitation to attend on the basis that it was perhaps overly political and referenced his title as being President of the Republic of Ireland. And then yesterday we were told that Britain's Queen Elizabeth II would not be attending. The mass took place at 11 o'clock this morning. Virtually all of the relevant political parties in attendance, with the exception of Sinn Féin. Did it feel political in tone to you?
No, the mass itself definitely didn't. All the commentary around it did, no doubt about that. But the actual service itself, I mean, the closest it came to being political was when Archbishop Eamon Martin gave his speech. He kind of talked about feeling a sense of kind of a deep sense of hurt at the partition of Northern Ireland, and that maybe the churches could have done more 100 years ago to heal the wounds and the divisions that ultimately led to what happened. But other than that, it was very much a tone from the kind of five churches that were there, five faiths that were present within Christianity, and that it was working together, it was moving forward in Northern Ireland. That was commentary from political leaders in Northern Ireland who attended as well, afterwards who spoke to the likes of the DUP, of the SDLP and the Alliance Party, the UUP as well, all saying, look, this was an opportunity really to build bridges. And there was a big place in the ceremony as well for the views of young people. There were quite a few young people speaking, students from around Armagh, who were all talking about, look, we are the generation of peace. We've only known peace and we want to not only keep it, but to build on it so that there's a brighter future for Northern Ireland. So it has to be said that when it comes to the actual politicised nature of the service itself, that there really wasn't one, despite the commentary being very heavily polarised, if you like.
I would imagine that to many sitting there, the very soft mea culpa from the Primate of All Ireland, certainly from the Roman Catholic perspective, Eamon Martin, that the church could have done more 100 years ago to try and heal those divisions, might not have been widely anticipated.
No, it wasn't. I think he was probably the most forthright in acknowledging how it had affected particularly Catholic and nationalist communities, obviously because of who he's representing and was representing there. The other church leaders a little bit more pulled back or reserved in their comments. So that was a little bit of a surprise. And as I say, the time where it was closest, I suppose, to politicisation. And it was an interesting one. It was interesting to hear him take that particular tack and the significance of it in the wider centenary events that are going on.
Foreign Affairs Minister Simon Coveney and Minister of State Jack Chambers attended. What other representatives from Ireland were there?
So they were the only attendances really from political parties in the Republic of Ireland. You had all political parties from the north, with the exception of Sinn Féin, there as well. You had a representative of Her Majesty the Queen, Britain's Queen Elizabeth II, who, as you mentioned in the intro there, couldn't travel because of health reasons. Also the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, the biggest player, political player, who was there today, and the Secretary of State Brandon Lewis, also present. So quite a big cast of names from the UK side. But in terms of other Irish political parties, they decided not to go and went more along the line of what President Michael D. Higgins did.
Now, some of the organisers have described this as a unique service. As you say, five branches of the Christian faith represented. Given that the service is now over, in retrospect and in hindsight, Sean, does that the controversy seem to have been overblown to you?
Yeah, well, I think so. I always was a little bit confused about why President Higgins took such a hard tack line as he did. Now, he said the title of the particular event was to politicise, and that wasn't his role as president. And of course, he does have to be careful in his role as president to be politically neutral. But the title was a ceremony to mark the part, both, it included both sides of the coin, if you like, to mark the partition of Northern Ireland and the foundation of the state of Northern Ireland, so the partition of the whole island, trying to take both in. Very much the tenor from the church element of things was very down the middle, trying to respect both sides of the coin. So Michael D. Higgins, really, in his rejection of it, is the one who ramped this up into something else, and Sinn Féin then jumping on board. But you had Colm Eastwood of the SDLP come out afterwards and say, anyone who sat through and watched that and listened to it today, that there's no way they could have said that that was divisive or that was overly politicised. And he very much defended, he was asked, well, as a Republican yourself, how do you take the criticism from other Republicans that you shouldn't have gone, that this is an event that marked a traumatic time in the history of Ireland, it divided our country, and that we're still dealing with the scars of that. And he said, look, I am a Republican, I want to see the end of partition, but we are not going to do that by talking to ourselves and attending events like this with the unionist community, events that are designed to have a little bit of introspection into what Northern Ireland actually is and how communities interact with each other. That's the way you're going to get progress, not sitting back and just castigating everything without actually being there to make an input.
Political correspondent Sean DeVoe, thank you indeed for joining us. The National Advocacy Service for People with Disabilities has released two keynote studies examining different facets of life for people with disabilities during the course of the pandemic. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line now by National Manager Louise Loughlin. Louise, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks, Ciara.
I suppose we'll take the first report first, and that was a study of an assessment of the issues faced by people with disabilities in residential services and day services during the COVID-19 pandemic. I would imagine in particular for people attending day services, they didn't exist, so the issues were profound.
That would be right, Ciara. I suppose there's two main aspects to it, as you say, the residential services and disease services. And as many of your listeners will be familiar, that along with many of our other services, day services ceased completely for a number of months. And many of them are still not fully opened yet, but they're still operating on a limited basis. So that had a hugely detrimental impact for people on their mental health and well-being. People experienced increased loneliness and isolation as a consequence of not being able to access their day service. Their routines were disrupted, and they perhaps had no one else to share that loneliness with. They may have been living alone. Mm. And one of the other impacts of that would be that, you know, perhaps adults with disabilities who were in a regular routine of going to a day service became more dependent on their parents for support and for social interaction. And so that would have led to increased pressures in the household. So it really was a very traumatising time for everyone.
We haven't heard as much discussion, certainly in wider society, about the impact on people with disabilities who were living in a residential setting.
Yeah, and that was one of the reasons we wanted to get this information out there, because obviously the whole focus over the period of the pandemic, we've had, you know, we've all had to live through the public health restrictions. We've all have had restrictions on our normal routines, and we've all experienced isolation to a greater or lesser extent. But I think if we think of it in the context of residential services for people with disabilities, people weren't used to having quite active lives, you know, family members coming and going, people able to leave their residential services to go to day services or to go to work or to socialise. And that all really stopped. And because a lot of residential services are still, you know, what are termed congregated settings, in some ways they had the same risks as nursing homes, in that, you know, you had groups of people living together, and they, you know, they had to bring in high levels of infection control into residential services in the same way that was done with nursing homes. And what that meant was, you know, what is people's homes became much more of a clinical setting, and, you know, people had to be segregated from their friends, you know, living in isolation in a residential service. So we were keen that that message would come out, that it wasn't just people living in nursing homes or people cocooning at home that were affected by the impact and the consequences of the pandemic, that there's a whole cohort of people with disabilities have also been affected in this way.
And I would imagine that from a certain standpoint, their clinical assessment of being a congregated setting and not someone's home had a profound impact on the way in which cocooning or self-isolating or restricting occurred and was managed from the beginning of the pandemic.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, we had stories from people who found that, you know, that they had to stay in a certain area of a residential service because there perhaps already was an infection on the site or a concern about a potential infection. And so people kind of had to be treated in the same way that our hospitals and nursing homes did, that, you know, they had to separate people out. And really a lot of residential services, be they big, you know, large congregated settings or smaller, you know, what are often called group homes, they are first and foremost people's homes where they live. People have been living there for many years. Some people, you know, express a wish to move out. Others are very happy with their circumstances. And, you know, one of the other things that came through in our reports was also the understanding of people who use our services around what was going on. So the communication that was coming in, you know, the public health measures that we're all so familiar with and that have been everywhere, you know, all of our radio, media and TV and every shop we go into, it was difficult for people who were living in an isolated environment to fully comprehend that and to understand the whole piece around keeping a distance, washing hands, and mask wearing. That was a big jump for people to make that transition. And what we found as well is that the communication around that was not all that it could have been. And, you know, we had to support people to understand what was happening across the whole world, you know, and then how that affected them in their own particular circumstances. So, yeah, it was absolutely very challenging.
The second report examines access to justice and decision making. And this report, Louise, examines matters of profound import, such as do not resuscitate cases, issues in terms of parenting with a disability, safeguarding concerns, next of kin cases.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's a lot in there. And as you see, they're quite profound matters as well that really go to the heart of our health and social care and wider public services. So I suppose some of the experiences that we came across were perhaps someone was in a hospital or a nursing home environment and it was found that there was a do not resuscitate order marked on their medical records. And in fact, the person's own view hadn't been ascertained around that the decision had been made in consultation with family members. And I suppose that leads me on to just the wider point that is often a misconception in Ireland around the capacity, or sorry, I should say the legal standing of what next of kin actually means. So next of kin really is should be no more than the name and phone number of the person to be contacted in an emergency. Mm. Next of kin doesn't bestow anyone a status that they can make a decision on behalf of someone else. And I think, you know, Ireland has kind of operated on that basis for a long time, and I think we're slowly coming out of that now. So
we've kind of operated on, this is a statement based on anecdotal evidence only, as if next of kin means the US version of having power of attorney.
Yeah, and that is kind of, that is the reality of how things have operated, and often for good reason, because, you know, there is, you know, currently we don't have an updated, modernised capacity regime in terms of decision making. So people have had to find solutions, you know, and you can't be going into court and asking the High Court to make a decision every time a decision needs to be made for someone. So that is why we've developed this kind of ad hoc system of decision making, but it really came to the fore during the course of the pandemic, both around those do not attempt resuscitate orders and around the vaccine as well, because many services, residential services for people with disabilities, found themselves in quite challenging situations whereby vaccination was coming to their setting, it was being offered to all of the residents, and some family members did not want their loved one to receive the vaccine. And so we had to do quite a lot of work in that space in terms of supporting the service provider to ensure that they could hear what the person wanted and to help the person understand as best they could about what it means to receive the vaccine and to reach a decision around that. And that's quite complex because we all had to make a decision around the vaccine. You know, we all had to weigh up the pros and cons of it, and, you know, can be quite controversial for some people as well. So that was a complex piece of work that we had to do, and that's still ongoing in some locations as well. So, but I think what it does show you is that by doing that kind of engagement with the person with the disability, who may have an intellectual disability, that you can actually reach a point where you can ascertain that they wish to receive their vaccine and that they can go ahead on that basis, you know. So I think that just underlines the importance of the advocacy in that process.
Louise Loughlin, National Manager of the National Advocacy Service for People with Disabilities, thank you indeed for joining us. Do remember, comments, requests or dedications by text or WhatsApp to 0833 97 97 97. Now, 35,000 CO2 monitors are being delivered to schools up and down the land. That delivery began in August and is continuing today. I'm joined on the line to discuss this by Dr. Dennis McCauley, Chairperson of the GP Subcommittee at the Irish Medical Organisation. He's also a practising GP in Donegal. Dennis, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
And now, 35,000 sounds like an inordinate amount of CO2 monitors. But if you think about it, here in County Kildare, we have 120-odd schools. Each of them would have multiple number of rooms. So it means that some schools may get as few as 20, dependent upon if you're in primary level, and second level schools could get up to 35 monitors. Is that sufficient?
I'm not sure about the actual sufficiency. I suppose the important thing is to have them in the rooms where there are a large number of people gathering. I think, remember, just what are these for? When we breathe in oxygen and we breathe out carbon dioxide. So it is just a waste product. So these monitors are there to sort of tell us when that amount of waste gas actually gets to a certain level. Why is that important? It is really important in that we know that COVID spreads very comfortably in areas that aren't ventilated. So if it's a situation there's quite a high level of carbon dioxide in a room, it means that the room isn't being ventilated. So it's a bit like having an actual canary in the mine. It actually warns you that there is a situation that could allow COVID to spread so much easier. So I think how many, I really am not involved in the actual rollout of the numbers, but I think if the school got a certain amount of these, they would say, well, where are the areas where the more at-risk population gather in a large number, and that's how you would spread it out.
It gives schools a certain amount of control over how they manage their environment as well, and because it's indicative, it can prompt immediate action in ventilation terms if that's required.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's just a warning. It's just saying, listen, the air quality here is such that we just know that the waste product that you're breathing isn't being removed quickly enough. So therefore, that means it's an ideal environment for COVID, the actual Delta variant, to actually spread. There is also probably a health issue as well. It means that the level of CO2 is up, so therefore the concentration of oxygen is down. So the general performance of your brain will not be as good. No, it's a very marginal effect, but it means it'll be a healthier environment to think in. But more importantly, it'll be a much healthier environment from the point of view of trying to reduce the spread of this very infectious virus.
Now, I've never been next to or near a CO2 monitor. Are they easy to use? Are they easy to install? Easy to maintain?
They're just the same. Once again, I'm not the world's expert on the actual electrics, but I have seen them. They're very similar to a smoke monitor. Really.
Oh, Grant, yeah, because I had this image in my head of some kind of large doohickey you'd have to wheel into a classroom.
I think not. It won't be the large elephant in the room. It'll be the subtle thing stuck in the corner, hopefully.
Well, Dr. Dennis McCauley, chairperson of the GP subcommittee of the Irish Medical Organisation, thank you indeed for joining us. I'm joined on the line now by Dara O'Loughlin, Chief Executive of the Irish Pharmacy Union. Dara, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much, Ciara. I'm delighted to be here.
We're delighted to have you. There's kind of two things we're going to be talking about this afternoon, both pertaining to the COVID-19 booster campaign. And I suppose first we might look at your members, because we know that booster shots have been approved for people over the age of 60 and people in certain congregated settings, but not in the general course of events for most healthcare workers, in which one would include pharmacists.
That's right. Yes, the recommendation so far is that people living in the community who are aged 60 or above are eligible for a booster shot, people aged 65 and older in long-term care facilities. But there's been no decision made about offering booster shots to healthcare workers, including pharmacists and pharmacy teams, even though it is arguable that they should be in line for a booster shot now, because firstly, the healthcare workers were among the first and were privileged to have been among the first people to get vaccinated earlier this year, which means it's now 6 months since a lot of them were vaccinated. And most of them will have received the AstraZeneca vaccine, which has been identified as a vaccine where you get significant waning in immunity once 6 months have elapsed. And also, we do know that giving people who've had AstraZeneca 6 months ago a booster dose of an mRNA vaccine like Pfizer or Moderna then restores substantial immunity and protects our healthcare workers. We're seeing increased cases of COVID now cropping up in healthcare settings with staff in hospitals and frontline staff in GP, general practice and in pharmacies contracting COVID. Not always necessarily at work. It could be from community spread. But what we don't want is to have our healthcare workers catching COVID and then not in a position to come to work and take care.
I am not an immunovirologist, but it would seem logical that if those people who were in the first couple of cohorts of people to whom vaccinations were administered way back beginning last December, that those same cohorts of people might be considered for booster vaccinations. And we know also that senior ministers, including Simon Harris, are kind of scratching their heads as to try to understand why NIAC has not included healthcare workers in its approval or recommendation of booster campaigns.
Yes, NIAC's assertion is that the clinical evidence isn't there in sufficient quantity to justify that decision. I think our experience actually throughout has been that NIAC moved very steadily and very carefully they don't necessarily give the wrong advice, but they give the err on the side of caution. Their advice is always prudent and comes more slowly than we would expect it. But there's tremendous data coming out of Israel, where their vaccination campaign started ahead of almost anybody else's. And so more time has elapsed, and they've also kept a lot of data. They've measured immune response, they've measured antibody levels and so on, and they have seen a significant waning in people who got vaccinated early, and they're seeing a very significant improvement in people's immune status once they've had a booster dose. So I expect that NIAC will continue to review the advice, and I expect that NIAC will come to a decision that healthcare workers should receive a booster dose, because that's the direction that the evidence is bringing us.
And but that would come with the caveat that NIAC, as you have said, errs on the side of caution. It takes its deliberations very seriously and may take some little time to arrive at that adjudication, if indeed it so does. On now to the second part of the Irish Pharmacy Union's interest and engagement with the booster campaign is, I would imagine that your members actively want to be involved in the rollout of booster vaccinations.
Yes, pharmacies campaigned from the start of the year to be involved and to be included in the vaccination programme, because in the depths of a pandemic, everybody wants to know that they have had the opportunity to do everything they can do to help society and to help people to come out of it. Pharmacists were included in the initial high-level plan that the task force drew up, and then, for reasons that we're not clear on, the HSE didn't activate pharmacies and didn't commence vaccination through pharmacies until the summer. And when they did, we saw huge public demand to get a vaccine in a pharmacy, because people really value the convenience and the accessibility of a local pharmacy. They value not having to travel to another town or another district to go to a large vaccination centre. And then this week, as the plans for the booster campaign were announced through the media, there was no mention of boosters being administered or being available in pharmacies. Instead, people were being told that they would have to go either to their GP or to a mass vaccination centre. And we're hearing from GPs that they are overworked and in many cases don't have the capacity to take on a mass booster campaign. So it makes no sense. It's quite bewildering that pharmacies would be excluded from it. And we haven't seen any finalised formal plans, but all of the indications through the media that we've seen have been that it's only vax centres and GPs that are part of the mix at the moment.
I'm gathering, Dara, that because of your reference to having gleaned this information through the media, that nobody from any of the relevant government agencies has actually been directly in contact with the union.
We have been talking with the HSE and we've had no clarity from them. We've had outline discussions, but no confirmations and no clarity. And we do know that they have corresponded with GPs to tell them how the vaccination booster programme should work, that there are plans in place to activate the vaccination centres again. But so far, we don't even have a functioning IT system in pharmacies to record the vaccination dose, because the HSE's vaccination system called PharmaVax that pharmacists use doesn't yet have the capacity to record a third dose. It's a tiny piece of programming, but it's symptomatic of the delays we're facing that hasn't even been done.
And I would imagine in the face of all of those various particular facets, it may come as no surprise to you to hear that Tony Coulhan says it will be a significant amount of time before anyone under 40 would be given a booster vaccination. If the structures aren't there to deliver it efficiently, surely that would seem logical.
Absolutely, because we know that there are about 800,000 people in Ireland aged 60 or over, all of whom are now in line to get a booster. That's a significant cohort of people. We should be maximising our capacity to deliver them. But also the key thing, and this might be what Dr. Hulahan's talking about, is that the booster jab isn't due until 6 months after your second vaccine dose. And most people under 40 got their vaccination a lot less than 6 months ago. So it would be the early part of next year, probably moving towards Easter, before people would have 6 months elapsed since their second dose.
Surely then now would be the time to begin putting the structures in place to ensure the smooth rollout of booster doses for the largest cohort of the population by per head.
I agree. I think what we should be doing is putting structures in place so that we can take a steady, sustained, methodical approach to doing boosters and have enough vaccination locations in convenient locations there, so that when the 6 month lapses for people, and they are then due their booster. I think we all know when we got our vaccine, our first and second doses, and if we forget, it's on our digital COVID cert. So people can keep an eye on that date and make an appointment for when the 6 months has elapsed, and then get that. So that we're gradually working through the population on the basis that they, in the same order that people were originally vaccinated. But to do that, we should activate all the vaccination capacity so that we're not inundating any one part of the system, whether that's vaccination centres or GPs. We should make it as easy as possible for people to get the vaccine as conveniently as possible and as close to home as they can.
Dara O'Loughlin, Chief Executive of the Irish Pharmacy Union, thank you indeed for your time.